Good evening. It's good to be with you this evening and have the opportunity to speak to you. Appreciate the good prayer led by Brother Kurt and the songs led by Brother Tim, and I appreciate the opportunity given to me by the elders to speak to you this evening. Tonight, I was looking at some different things that I wanted to talk about, some different things that I wanted to discuss, some things that really just stuck out in my mind, and I looked around and I started looking at things that were going on in current events and things that were going on in our world at large. And I started thinking, wow, there's a sermon to be preached on so many different topics and so many different things. And there's just so many specific issues at hand. And I started thinking, okay, well, what about a sermon considering the topic of marriage and what does it mean nowadays versus what God means for it? And I thought, wow, that would be really powerful. That's really moving. And then I started thinking about, what about a sermon about prejudice, about hate? And in our world today, how those words are used, but maybe not understood. I thought about maybe even just a lesson, a sermon, if you will, about the need for unity. And I started thinking, you know, those sermons were preached 2,000 years ago. And there were people that listened. And there were people that ignored. And there were people that listened and said, yes, we agree with you. We think that you are on the right track. But please, please don't ask us to change anything. So I started thinking, well, what's the bigger issue? What's the bigger issue? You know, maybe we don't need 100 sermons on defining what marriage is. Well, if I were to take even some of our young men and women in this audience right now, even our third and fourth graders perhaps, and I were to sit them down and ask them, what is marriage? I would venture to guess that at least the majority of them would say it's a man marrying a woman and staying married for a lifetime. If I were to take even my daughter's age, the five-year-old group, and I were to say, is it okay to hate people? Oh, I'd venture to guess that the majority of them would say, no, it's not okay to hate people. You shouldn't hate people. If I were to take anybody in this audience and say, is it good when people work together to do things? I'd venture to guess that everyone in here would say, absolutely, that's a good thing. So here's the problem that I see, just my personal opinion. You can disagree with me if you want. That's okay, we'll both go to heaven, that's fine. Here's the issue at hand. It's not these specific issues. There's something else going on. Something much bigger. Something much broader, something that will affect us from this point forward, because you see, it affected those 2,000 years ago. And as Solomon wrote, there's nothing new under the sun. So what's the issue? The issue is, I think, too many people in too many churches, in too many cities, in too many states, in too many countries around the world honestly believe that because they sat in a pew, they're right. I can put it even simpler than that. I think that there's too many people in too many churches, in too many cities, in too many states, in too many countries, and all around the world who have way too much pride. See, unfortunately, in many cases, some of us have become just like the Pharisees of old. We check the things off of our list that we are supposed to do. We check the things off of our list, the places we're supposed to be, the times we're supposed to be there. We occasionally mix in the random act of kindness, and we just assume that that means that we're fine. I started thinking, what would I talk about? What can I do on a Sunday night in the middle of July when it's 150 degrees outside and people are miserable outside and people don't even really want to get in their cars and come to church because it's too hot. The preacher's boring. It's Sunday night after all. So what can I say? What am I going to talk about that's actually going to mean something? Because you see, I could get up here and I could tell you that marriage between anyone else other than a man and a woman is wrong. And you know what? Everybody in here would nod along. And when I got finished, would shake my hand on the way out the door and they would say, boy, you did a good job. And you know what? I'd get in my car and I'd go, you know what? I told them what they already know. Did it really impact anybody? I don't know. So as anybody that's ever stood up here, anybody that's ever stood in front of an audience and preached before will tell you, here's what you have to do. You have to preach the sermon to yourself. So this sermon I preached to myself. And I'll tell you when I preached it to myself. I was sitting at church camp 2 weeks ago. And it was 150 degrees. And we were miserable. And there were bugs everywhere. And I was sitting at a table in this cafeteria. And there's people all around me. And I have my computer out and I'm looking over some things and thinking about what I want to talk about. And I kind of looked up and started looking around. And I noticed that all around me were some 200 and some odd kids studying the Bible. Studying the Bible. 200 young people voluntarily came to a place in the middle of nowhere with it 100 and something degrees outside to study the Bible. It just happened this past week too, by the way, if you didn't know. A big group of people, teenagers, young people, old people, all alike, went to Camp Neati last week and they studied the Bible. So I started thinking, what makes those kids that I was sitting in the middle of and the kids at Camp Neati this past week, what makes them different from the rest of the world who, when you turn the news on, you go, man, this place is going down in a hurry. What is it about that group that makes them different? I said, this is what it is. They have allowed themselves to be broken. They have allowed themselves to be broken. And what I mean by that is simply this. When you go to church camp, you don't go with all the amenities of your own house. You can't just walk down to the kitchen and get something to eat if you're hungry in the middle of the night. For the most part, you are absolutely disconnected from any sort of technology at all. You can't check Twitter, Facebook. You can't post pictures to Instagram and see how many likes you get. Believe me when I tell you, adults, you may think that that's all crazy. Believe me when I tell you that there is a generation of young people that judge themselves by how many likes they get on a certain thing in their social media. You parents, you better tune in to what your kids are doing, what your kids are posting, what your kids are liking, what your kids are looking at. Because I will tell you, it has become so easy now through social media to come in contact with A, people that you don't need to be in contact with, and B, things that you don't need to see, hear, or read. Trust me when I tell you this. Parents, get involved. But you see, these kids were different. These kids allowed themselves to be broken. And they started taking to heart things that actually had some value. They started believing things like what you see in Matthew chapter 11. That Jesus actually did mean exactly what He said. Jesus meant exactly what He said. These were young people that were doing this. These were adults in their 30s, their 40s, their 50s, their 70s, that were sitting with these kids and studying the Bible with them, because these were adults that were saying, If only when I was 20, when I was 15, when I was 12, if somebody would have sat down with me and laid out the Bible like we're doing at camp. Like I'm going to try to do it for you tonight. If only somebody had done that for me. Let me tell you something personal. I'll be 32 at the end of this month. 32 years old, okay? Let me explain to you the first time I ever had a real Bible study. I was 21 years old. I went through my entire teenage years at a church that told you it was okay to feel your way through the Bible. I was 21. I was married. And I had a wife that said, "Did you look over your stuff for Bible class Sunday morning?" I said, "Shh." She said, "No, really, did you look over your stuff?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, you might want to." I said, "Ah, it's just Bible class. I mean, we just sit in there and talk about..." "No, no." See, for the first time I went to a church where they said, "Hey, we're going to study the Bible. We're going to go through this passage of Scripture right here. We're going to take it apart." And my eyes got as big as you could possibly imagine. Because I said, "Wow. Wow, I didn't even know all that was in there. I didn't even know what that meant." You know, to me, I just knew the Bible was just that book that sat on my dresser, and I picked it up on Sunday morning, laid it down on Sunday afternoon, picked it up again on Wednesday night, because I wasn't taking my Bible to church on Sunday night because the preacher was boring. Some of y'all can quit hiding because y'all left your Bible at home tonight too. That's all right. And now all of a sudden for me it was an eye-opening experience. The Bible meant something. It meant something. Changed the way that I looked at everything. For the first time in my entire life, I actually understood what it meant to be a Christian, like a legitimate Christian, not a Christian by word only, not a Christian by, "Let me beat my chest and tell you that I go to church." No, no, no. I actually knew what it meant to be a Bible-believing, God-fearing Christian. For the first time in my life, I allowed myself to be broken. All the pride went away. Because you know what I realized? I didn't know anything. And so I sit there at camp and I'm typing and I'm talking to people. And this verse stuck out to me. This verse stuck out to me. Because it was the verse I remember reading as I was trying to do my own personal Bible study. I'd never done one before. I didn't even know what that meant. So I went to a Bible bookstore and I bought me one of those Bibles that's the read through the Bible in a year, 2 years, whichever plan you choose, and you can read through the Bible. So I went and bought me one of those. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. And it started with the Psalms. So I started reading through the Psalms. And I remember I got to Psalm 8, and I remember there was a song in a songbook that I remember singing when I was young that was the first verse of Psalm 8. So I was like, "Oh, okay, I remember this psalm." And then I read it and I thought, "No, I don't remember it. I remember the first verse." And I got to verses 3 and 4, and this just stopped me in my tracks. "When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? And the Son of Man that you care for him." See, it changed everything for me. Because I got to thinking about the fact that there was a God. I never once doubted that God existed. Even as I began studying the Bible for the first time for real, I never doubted that God existed. I didn't know enough about him. And as I learned about him, I began thinking, wait a minute, you're telling me that the same God that said, "Let there be light," and there was light, the same God that told Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 to pack up and move because he had a plan for him, the same God that Joseph said in Genesis chapter 50, "Those things that you meant for evil, God meant for good," that same God is actually desiring a relationship with me. And I thought, that makes no sense to me. I can't logically put those things together and it come out making sense. That equation doesn't balance for me, because God is God and I am not. I'm not worthy of that. And so I found this to be sort of a verse that just, it encapsulated everything that I thought of myself. God, when I look outside and I see all the things that you've done, Romans chapter 1 says what? That His invisible attributes have been made clearly seen. God, when I look around and I see all the things that you've done, that you've created, that you are the master of, who am I? At what point do I even rank on your list of things to care about? God's not interested in your self-pity. Let me stop you before you even start going down that road. God is not interested in your self-pity. He was not interested in mine either. He was not interested in me playing poor, poor, pitiful me and sitting on the sidelines and acting as though basically my life is over. God's not interested in your pity party. He's not interested in your self-pity. God is saying to you, yes, I want a relationship with you, but it's not going to stop there. I have plans for you. But now, let me stop for a second and let's talk about the fact that we live in a world that says God can't exist because that's an absolute. You say God exists and that puts a period where there should be a question mark. That's what your society, that's what my society says right now, is that God exists shouldn't be a sentence. It should be a question mark. It should be a question. God exists? Maybe He does, maybe He doesn't. That's the society that we live in, correct? Maybe He does, maybe He doesn't. That's up to you, but don't get on me if I tell you that He doesn't. See, this whole disagreement has been going on for a very long time. This disagreement has been going on for a very long time. Look at these things. Look at these quotes. There is no such thing as an absolute truth to be discovered, T.L. Hume said. Now, I hate to break it to him. For him to make that statement infers that there is an absolute truth. So they caught on. They caught on to our little game. So a guy by the name of Paul Feyerabend said, the only absolute truth is that there are no absolute truths. How about this? If absolute truth belongs to anyone in this world, it certainly does not belong to the man or party that claims to possess it. That's the world that you and I live in. That's the world that my kids are growing up in. That's the world that your kids, your grandkids, your nieces, nephews, etc. are growing up in. See, God can't be real in the world. Because you see, if we admit that God is real in the world, then that changes everything that we're A, allowed to do, and everything that B, we're allowed to be. If God is a question mark, then the world can move on just as it sees fit. They can do whatever they want. They can live however they want, say whatever they want, and honestly, at the end of the day, it's a coin flip to see what happens when we die. That's if God doesn't exist, or if God is simply a question mark in the world today. The problem with that thinking is that God most certainly exists. And if He most certainly exists, and He does, then what that means is the very Word of God, the Bible, is absolute truth. See, now that's stirring up a hornet's nest. Because now that means I've got to take that book that you all have, either on your phone, your iPad, or maybe even you have the copy in your hand, the hard copy. You see, now I've got to take that book and I actually got to do what it says. Now, preacher, now you messed up. I was with you right up until that point. Preacher, it's a lot easier to live in this world. It's a lot easier to live here. It's a lot easier to think that, you know, the truth is, honestly, if absolute truth does exist, then it doesn't belong to the people that claim to have it. Because if it does exist and it does belong to those people that claim to have it, those crazy Christian people and their Bible, then that means I can't live my life the way I want to live my life. I can't do what I want, say what I want, live how I want to live. That means I actually have to hold to a standard. I hate to be the bearer of good news, maybe. But even a philosopher by the name of Blaise Pascal said this: truth is so obscured nowadays, and lies so well established, that unless we love the truth, we shall never recognize it. Honestly, I think we have come to a point in our society and in our world that even some who claim to love the truth don't even recognize it. They claim to, but you know what? It doesn't fit their agenda. It doesn't fit their political aspirations. It doesn't fit what it takes to keep 35,000 sitting in an audience claiming to go to church. So while we claim to love the truth, there are some out there who don't even recognize it. Romans chapter 3, Paul wrote these words: let God be true, though everyone were a liar. Here's what you and I better wake up to. This is reality. This is reality. I told the young adult Bible class this morning, I said, the beautiful thing about truth is that it's true. Sometimes the worst thing about truth is that it's true. Here's the truth. Here's the absolute truth. That if every single one of us in this room right now were to fall away, God forbid, if we were to fall away and never again follow God, God would still be God. He would still be God. If every man, woman, child, etc. in the entire world turned against God, God would still be God. That's absolute truth, whether you and I like it or not. You see, a lot of people for some reason have got it in their head that God actually needs them to accomplish His goal. That I'm doing God a favor by being a follower of His. That God, honestly, you should be lucky to have me. And that's how they treat God. That's how they treat the church. That's how they treat the Bible. That's how they even treat Jesus Christ. You should just be lucky that I'm here. I hate to break it to you. Some of us come in this building right here with that exact attitude. We sing the songs. We bow our heads when the prayers are led. We even partially pay attention when somebody's up here talking. But the truth is, we came in tonight and we said, you know what, Bethel's just lucky to have me. God, you're just lucky to have me. You're just lucky that I'm here. Let me, in a loving way, tell you, that couldn't be further from the truth. If the entire world turned against God, God would still be God. And He would still be right, though every person turned against Him. David said it this way in Psalm 119. He said, the sum of your word is truth. The sum of your word is truth. And then look at this last part. And every one of your righteous rules endures forever. I got some bad news for people. There's no expiration date on the Bible. They're not going to wake up one day and say, okay, that Bible that you've been holding to for the last 50 years of your life, okay, you don't have to do that anymore. You made it to age 50, you're a Christian, congratulations. You have completed the course. It doesn't work that way. David said, every one of your righteous rules endures forever. It's a constant. If we know then that the gospel, and for that matter, the scriptures are absolute truth, then we can know that the God of the Bible is the true God of heaven and earth. We can know that. You see, a lot of people are confused. They don't know, maybe, that they can know God. They don't know that. You can know God beyond a shadow of a doubt. You don't have to go to bed at night thinking, I hope, I wish, maybe. No, you can know God. You can know God, and therefore you can know His truth. And here's what you need to know. Here's the ultimate end of that equation. If you know God and you know His truth is absolute, then you know that you are right. And if you can't lay your head down at night knowing those things, what is it that's in the way? What is it that's in the way? We mentioned Romans chapter 1 earlier. If you turn there and you begin in verse 16, you're going to find Paul basically laying down the law, cliche that we've used for dozens of years, laying down the law to the Romans. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, Paul says. Paul is almost, it's almost as though he feels that he has to defend himself about teaching them the truth. You don't get it. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Because it is the power unto salvation. There's a reason why I love the gospel. I hope that you love it too. There's a reason why I love it. It's because it is the power unto salvation. It is what saves you. You understand? Then Paul continues on. And ultimately he begins to lay out some things that are not so pretty, that are not so comforting, that are not so nice, but that in a scary way sound really familiar. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they're without excuse. For although they knew God, they didn't honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened, claiming to be wise. They became fools. And the last part of verse 23 really, I think, maybe hurts the worst because of how foolish these people sounded and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. It's a scary thought when you consider the fact that God created everything. And in creating everything, He actually gave us access to know who He is. And yet, there is a large segment of the population of our world who consistently deny that He exists. You see, I don't get it. If I were to walk out tonight and I were to look up and see this, see all these stars and galaxies and all these things, you see, I would look up and I would be amazed. But you know, there are people out there that actually look up there and they view themselves and they view the world as insignificant. They see these stars, they see these galaxies, these planets, and they say, boy, I am just nothing. That's not what God intended. No, you see, what God intended was for a Christian to look into the sky and see affirmation. Affirmation of a faith that is built upon a God that spoke everything into existence. Everything into existence. I hate to break it to some in our world today, but you can't honestly get me to believe that some 18, by the way, about 10 years ago it was 14, Now it's 18. About 18 trillion years ago, in the middle of nothing, something happened. You can't honestly expect me to believe that, right? That 18 trillion years ago, in an expanse of nothing, something appeared. Now that makes no sense to me. Next time somebody tells you that the Big Bang Theory is real, please ask them one simple question. If there was nothing and something appeared, where did the something come from? They have no answer, by the way. Let me give you the spoiler. They don't have an answer. They say, well, it just appeared. And at that point, I have to tell them, do you understand that it takes way more faith to be an atheist than it does to be a Christian? Atheists look at us like we're crazy because we believe in a divine being that created everything, that spoke into existence everything. They think we're absolute lunatics for believing in that, but yet they themselves believe that 18 trillion years ago, and that number, by the way, is going to only keep growing because what they're finding is they don't have enough time to get everything in 18 trillion years. So give them about 5 more years, it'll be up to 20. In 10, it'll be 22. In 15, it'll be 25. And before you know it, they'll be at 100 trillion and moving on. Just to get everything in. See, they look up in the sky and they see something that makes them feel insignificant and small, powerless. It makes them feel as though they don't matter. I look up and I see a loving God who said, "Let there be light," and there was light. I see a loving God who created the planet that we live on. I see a loving God, by the way, who made our solar system in a perfect form where you and I could live. I was reading an article not too long ago, and it was talking about the fact that if our planet, if its orbit was an eighth of an inch closer to the sun, we would all burn up and die. Think about that, an eighth of an inch. We're talking about an orbit here. We're talking about an entire planet. An eighth of an inch? Yes, an eighth of an inch closer to the sun, we all die. Same article said, an eighth of an inch further away on our orbit line, we freeze to death and die. An eighth of an inch! An eighth of an inch. And you tell me that that happened by chance? There's no way. There's no way. But then, you see, the mind boggles because then you have the crowning moment of God's creation. He's creating us. See, on the sixth day, He created us. Genesis 1:26 says, in His image. And not to do nothing. No, instead to be collaborators, to work alongside Him. That's the most unbelievable part of the whole deal, is that God said, I'm going to create you in My image. And then I'm going to put you to work. The problem is, over time, you see, we've kind of messed that up a little bit. We've begun to live our lives in our own image. We've begun to put our own selves in front of what God would have us to be. And so here's what God simply says. God says, until you're willing to be broken, you're not in My image anymore. It's hard for us to hear. Because we think we've got it all put together. We think that our world is all exactly as we would have it. And the truth is, we are missing out. We're missing out on a relationship with God. So those pieces of our own image have to be broken away. And then God says the most amazing thing. God says, I'll put the pieces actually back together for you. Here's what we have to get over. God doesn't say that He's going to put our pieces back where they were. He says He'll put the pieces back where they need to be, in alignment with His image. You see, it's really simple. It's really simple. St. Augustine said it this way: "You've made us for yourself, Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you." See, it's really simple, because I can stand up here and I can tell you and I can show you how much God loves you and cares about you. I can tell you all day long, I can tell you what it is that God is willing to do and has done for you already. I can tell you all those things, and I can show you all those things, and we can, you know what, you can come forward tonight. We can discuss those things. And if you're not a Christian, you can be baptized tonight. I think about Saul. When Saul became Paul, he talked about the idea that he thought he was doing everything right, only to find out that he was working for his own image and not in the image of God. I think about Simon, the sorcerer, in Acts chapter 8. I think about the fact that when he looked at what the apostles were doing and he tried to buy their power with money, he was wanting for his own fame, fortune, image. He was working for his own image. And when Peter says, "No, you don't get it. Your money, your gold and your silver perish with you," Simon stopped. He said, I need prayer. Peter said, "Pray that the thought of your own heart might be forgiven you." And he said, "I can't. You pray for me." That opportunity is yours too. I look around and I see so many people that I view as so far above and beyond what it means to be a Christian in this audience tonight. I see so many people that I think extremely highly of. And so here's what I want to tell you. If you're struggling tonight, I'm going to be completely real with you and completely honest with you. I don't know of a better place to bring your struggles than to these people here. There are so many people in this room right now that will be more than happy to shake your hand, to hug you, to tell you that they will pray for you. And guess what? It's not lip service. They're not going to walk out there and badmouth you all the way to their house and talk about how bad of a person you are. They legitimately mean it. They will go home tonight with your name on their lips to pray for you to God Almighty. But it's got to start with you. None of those things happen because I want them to. I can want all day long, for those of you that aren't Christians, I can want all day long for you to be baptized until you are willing to be broken and allow God to mold you back in His image. There is nothing that I can do. All I can do is pray for you. If you're living outside of what God would have you to be, I can want you to come back and I can want you to be a faithful member of the Lord's church all that I want, but until you're willing to allow God to mold you back into His image, it doesn't matter how much we want it. It has to start with you. Tonight, if there's something on your heart, if there's something in between you and God, you need to know there is absolutely zero reason for you to walk out these doors tonight in that same condition. It might be that you need to come forward. There might be something that you need to acknowledge tonight. And if that's the case, then so be it. It might be that you want to become a Christian tonight. You've been thinking about it. You've been studying. You've been wondering. And now you know you want to become a Christian. And so that opportunity is yours as well. Or it could be that you just need to make your relationship with God right. Right where you stand. That you and Him need to have some moments alone for you to make things right with Him. Whatever the case may be, if you need to come tonight, come now as we stand and as we sing.